Danon Nutritia Campus is an open science education platform for healthcare professionals overseen by a not-for-profit foundation. The foundation is led by an independent board of medical professionals and academics with one clear goal: to advance the field of nutrition and health from infancy to old age through growing knowledge, training and education of healthcare professionals around the world in collaboration with medical and scientific communities.
So welcome to everybody that's joining this podcast on picky eating. This podcast followed an extremely successful webinar that we had on the spectrum of picky eating. My name is Dr. Roseanne Meyer. I'm a pediatric dietitian. I'll be chairing part of this podcast and I'll be aiding also in some of the questions and answers when they come up. It's my great pleasure to introduce two of our speakers for the webinar, and they will also be answering the questions of this podcast. The first one is Chris Smith. He's lead pediatric dietitian at the Children's Hospital in Brighton in the United Kingdom, with a huge amount of experience in picky eating, and he also delivered the first part of the presentation on the webinar. Second speaker would be Rebecca Thomas. Rebecca is a registered dietitian and she specializes in pediatrics with feeding difficulties, in particular also avoidant restricted food intake disorder, and she works in Baltimore in the United States. The way the podcast is going to work is we've divided all of the questions that were sent through in different sections. Now I'm going to start immediately off with a very nice section on causes of picky eating. And so I'm going to ask Chris Smith, who's joining us today, why do you think that picky eating seems to be getting more common?
Well, thank you very much, Roseanne, for that really kind introduction. I'm delighted to be back again to address this topic that hopefully people have found very useful. So, in answer to that first question then, why do you think picky eating seems to be getting more common? I think the first part is really, is it getting more common? I don't know whether we can fully conclude that. Certainly, the vast majority of data, maybe 90% of it, has really come in the last 20 years. And you saw this illustrated from the PubMed presentation in my lecture. I don't think we can conclude that perhaps before this, the situation didn't exist, when it's possible it just wasn't really of particular interest to the scientific community. But now, medical literature covers a much broader and wider range of fields, including childhood nutrition, which is still relatively young, but I think has seen a significant increased focus in recent years. So I think, you know, is it getting more common? Is difficult to know. And add on top of that, the lack of historical data. Also, we've got all these inconsistencies in studies, which do make it even harder to make that conclusion. Remember, most of the studies, particularly those recent ones, have actually the ones that have used the broadest definitions or the loosest characteristics for inclusion criteria. So this too kind of muddies the waters and our understanding. So firstly, I don't know if we can conclude it is, but based on the data that we've got available, then perhaps if it is getting more common and I had to speculate why, I would say that there are some sort of very small changes that we see on an individual level and some very broader, much more population differences. So certainly, very broadly, there's definitely been huge shifts in the last few decades in economies and communication. And I've no doubt they've had an impact and a huge influence on how we eat and therefore how our children eat. And certainly the best example here would be, for example, choice, which the choice that our children have now is perhaps unimaginable 50 or 100 years ago. I think one of the most powerful influences on what children eat now comes from the internet and screens, and specifically child-focused advertising. So we know that very young children are exposed to increased screen time. Advertisers know this, and they know to focus on advertising that will help promote their foods. And what's being promoted is fast foods and snacks, and what's being ignored and not being promoted is course fruit and vegetables that have limited commercial or financial interest but huge financial health implications. So I think there's those big kind of broader things that I think may have an influence, but then there's the little things about what happens in the individual houses that plays a role too. So definitely the lack of family meals, you know, modeling is the best research, the most proven benefit to address picky eating. But really, I think we know sadly that as we understand more about how mealtimes benefit, we're actually seeing them less and less in many cultures and countries because of less home cooking, longer working hours, more distractions, all those sorts of things. And lots of nice systematic reviews have shown us that the evidence is that family meals support better eating habits long term, lower rates of obesity, lower eating disorders, better physical health, better mental health. Because of all these, we really should promote family meals as a public health initiative, as well as the impact they can have on picky eating. So broadly speaking, in answer to your question, you know, why are picky eaters seem to become more common? Number one, I don't know whether they are. If they are becoming more common, then it's probably related to broad impacts from kind of culture and population based and on individual levels too.
Thank you, Chris. I think that's an extremely extensive answer. And I think you're right. It's an extremely complex topic. And I think also it depends on where you come from, which country, the cultural influences. But I think social structure, also grandmothers are not around anymore when it comes to feeding time. So I think it's all become much more complicated. You touched not only in the webinar, but also now on obesity. And one of the questions that came through was this, whether there's a link between overweight and picky eating. So has there anything been done in this specific field in relationship to being overweight and obesity? Because we often associate picky eating as being underweight the other way around.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this is a great question. I mean, I definitely believe that historically, concern and concentration with picky eating has definitely focused more on undernutrition. But definitely our view has become much more balanced to the extreme ends of nutritional status are now possible within picky eating. And as you saw from the presentation, the systematic review from 2018 did identify two studies that did show a positive association with picky eating and obesity. And several groups have hypothesized that picky eating or picky eaters are at higher risk of becoming overweight or obese, possibly due to their preference for higher calorie dense foods and decreased intake of fruit and veg. And this theory sounds plausible, but we don't really have a lot of longitudinal studies that can really illustrate this so conclusively for us. But we do have a few. One that's worth noting is the one published from 2018 from the Avon UK group. This did look longitudinally at growth and body composition in children who were picky eaters. And they took the picky eaters age 3 and then they followed them up and looked at them at 7 occasions up until the age of 17. And so this is exactly the kind of longitudinal study that we want to see to help us understand. And yes, in this study, picky eating was associated with an increased likelihood of being thin, but they did find this cohort of children who were obese. And again, it's difficult to tease out, you know, how many of those children are influenced by other factors, of course, in our obesogenic society. So certainly interest in this area is definitely increasing. And a message I think here for us is that we should be open-minded to the possibility of nutritional deficiencies despite the appearance of nutritional status. So obesity and overweight status in picky eaters is not automatically reassuring of nutritional adequacy of the diet.
That's an extremely important message, I think, Chris, that you're finishing off in that regard. Now, Chris, we're moving into the next domain in terms of questions, and this is the diagnosis of picky eating, which is a really tricky topic. One of the questions was, are there any diagnostic tools to diagnose children with picky eating, even if they're just diagnostic tools that are quick and easy, you know, like tick boxes? Are you aware of any diagnostic tools for picky eating?
That's a great question. I mean, as we discussed all the way through the lecture, there are many different definitions of picky eating, and therefore there's many different criteria out there. And really what we're looking at doing, I guess, with this question, what we're looking at addressing is about screening, you know, how to pick these children up quickly and efficiently. And when it comes to any screening process, we've got to find the balance. And that balance is between making these diagnostic criteria or questionnaires or screenings detailed enough to be conclusive, and at the same time, not excessively extensive that they simply aren't practical to use in clinical practice. And this difficult balance we see illustrated in when we look at nutrition screening tools. You know, this is where the definition of undernutrition is globally agreed. So it's even harder in a situation like picky eating, where we don't have a consistent agreed definition to try and pinpoint in this way. So there are a few different ones out there. And if you look, for example, in the literature, you look at the methodologies of many of the key studies, you'll see them there in the appendix. So many centers have established and adopted these in their clinical practice. But remember, it is multidimensional. So for example, you know, a questionnaire or a screening tool that only covers, for example, the child's behaviors, but fails to investigate parents' attitudes or other factors occurring at the meal, will only provide you part of the answer. And perhaps this won't be sufficient to actually be able to help. So whatever it is, it needs to find that balance between being usable for the people that we want to benefit, and at the same time, make sure it's specific enough to pick up the multidimensional aspects of picky eating.
I think that's a really good answer, and I think also highlights the complexity, because the problem is it starts with just the language. Do we talk about a difficult eater? Do we talk about a feeding difficulty? Do we talk about a fussy eater? And under each one of them, you'll get different publications, but for many of us, they might be exactly the same. So I think you're absolutely right. It goes to the core of what's your definition and what you're actually looking like. But there are some questionnaires, but as you said, some of them more complex than the others. So Chris, on going down further into the diagnosis of picky eating, I think this is a very good dietetic question. Do you regularly assess nutritional adequacy in your picky eaters with a nutritional assessment program? You know, one of those computerized program.
Okay, well, I think this is a great question. Now, my personal answer is yes, I do regularly use them. And why is it that I use them? Well, I use them because my role is to make that assessment. That is what I am responsible for. That's what my team expect me to do. And they rely on my conclusion just as much as the families. So I need to do a thorough job if there are concerns. But like all of you, I have a very busy job. So I need to be efficient and effective as much as I can. And ideally, I want a clear, objective assessment. And certainly, I found that families pre-completing food diaries, whether you go on to analyze them or not, is very efficient. Firstly, because taking a detailed food diary in clinic or food history can be very time consuming, and then can that then detract the time that you've got to assess other aspects. And secondly, because that then is very reliant on the memory of the parent and their emotional state at that point. So them writing it down and recording it in real time makes the information much more accurate. Certainly not perfect, but definitely better. So if you have a food diary in front of you, then of course you can ask more questions, you can probe in, explore different areas, get clarity, and then you may want to analyze it from there. And then certainly I find in some cases it may be very obvious that the food, you know, major food groups might be missing or certain nutrients are not represented. But in others, what might appear acceptable on the surface may have important gaps or imbalances. And I've definitely learned to be open-minded, no matter how much experience or expertise you may have. Second opinions, which is one way of looking at dietary analysis, can be really very useful, and they may differ from your assessment. In terms of the number of days that I would use, again, it's about finding a balance between, you want to collect sufficient information to be able to draw a conclusion, but again, you don't want to put too much burden on the person completing it, so that they don't do it to their best ability. If you look in some conditions, there are guidelines. So for example, in cystic fibrosis, the ECFS and the ESPGHAN guidelines say you should get a 3-day food diary. It's good published data to suggest that 3 days is as good as 7, which obviously has a much higher responder burden. But ultimately, we have to appreciate fundamental limitations of food diaries and their analysis. You know, they may be overreported, they may be underreported, maybe based on their perception, and the analysis is only as useful and only as conclusive as the data provided. So if the quality is poor, or for example, portion sizes aren't included, then it's very hard to truly draw those conclusions. But remember, it's not just what the children eat, but also how they eat. So just doing a dietary assessment, whether you analyze it or not, you're going to need to look at multidimensional aspects.
Thank you for that answer, Chris. So again, under the topic of diagnosis of picky eating, Rebecca, there was a question that I thought was really good to ask you.
And it said, the question is as follows. If a child eats less than 5 vegetables and 5 fruit, but this variety is based on what the family can actually provide, would you consider this as a picky eater?
So I would not consider this as a picky eater just because there is limited access to that food. It doesn't necessarily mean that that particular child is showing a distaste or a kind of lack of acceptance of that food. They have just been limited exposure. In that case, I would not rule out picky eating, but first we would have to try those foods and see if they're easily implemented. And if not, and it becomes a problem, then we can move forward in the diagnosis of picky eating.
I think that's an excellent answer. Chris, what have you got to add to that?
I guess I just wanted to add to that, that more broadly speaking, that picky eating, you know, isn't of course just based on fruit and vegetable intake alone. You can have a wide variety of fruits and vegetables in the child's diet, but they may have poor variety or intake of iron sources like meat or cereals, and their picky eating behaviors are more focused towards these foods. So I think it's worth just worth noting that really that it's sometimes we need a broad assessment of all nutrient intakes to perceive or to confirm a child as being a fussy or picky eater.
And I think the message really here is a thorough, a good nutritional assessment and putting it like a puzzle together rather than making a decision just on what is being said. So, and I think, Chris, you made that point also with your, you know, when do you do a nutritional assessment? We're now moving into the questions around really the practical advice for picky eating, and we had lots of questions on that. Chris, here one question really came through following on your presentation and saying, how many times would you let a child try a food to make a conclusion that they really dislike that food?
Okay, well, look, I've heard many different psychologists who work in this field quote many different numbers, from 5 to 20 tries before you can make that decision about whether a child uses likes that food or not. But I think generally speaking, the exact number is irrelevant. Really, it's the principle that's key. And that principle is that accepting a child's negative reaction to a new food on their first exposure is probably not enough. And that's because for one, we might misunderstand this reaction. So you give a toddler a new flavor, the reaction they present might be shock or confusion or surprise, and that's normal. They've never had it before. The problem is that parents may too quickly perceive this reaction as disgust, but it's quite normal to see those kind of responses. And this quick conclusion they draw means the child isn't then exposed to the food again, and it's immediately withdrawn from the foods that are offered. And this is where I think we make the mistake. Just once is not enough. So the principle that preference is built through exposure is widely discussed in the literature. And certainly I see this having an impact in the children that I look after. So whether you offer a food, you know, 5 or 10 times, the key is that you don't stop at once. And secondly, that you have a responsibility to have a reasonable cutoff after which you accept the child really doesn't like that food. You know, we're all entitled to our own likes and dislikes.
I think that's a really good answer, Chris. And I think repetition is very important. But repetition, I always say, does not mean forcing. And yes. I think an important message that needs to come through is to get a child to like a food does not mean you force a child to have it. And I'm sure all of us have got really good examples. If we're moving towards, and I'm particularly now thinking about picky eating, because we'll come to Rebecca about this same question to Arvid, but is there a simple step-by-step plan to help parents and children expand the food repertoire for a picky eater, specifically a picky eater?
A step-by-step approach. You know, I don't think necessarily there's one size that is going to fit all with children, but I think there are fundamental principles that are really important. You know, our main focus is to get that proper assessment done and to do that in an efficient and effective way. And then I think you're broadly, you know, you need your key goals. And while the emphasis may be different for two different children, your basic fundamental goals are always going to be the same. You need to ensure the adequacy of your diet so the child comes to no harm. You've got to show modelling of mealtimes in a positive environment, and you've got to set clear expectations for the families. You know, this is not a quick fix. You can't solve picky eating overnight. And I think it's really important that our families understand this, that it takes a bit of time and it takes a bit of work, but we can get there.
And Chris, just an add on to the question, do you think being exposed to peers makes a difference with picky eaters? So, you know, seeing a friend eating something, does that, in your experience, make a difference?
Absolutely. I think, you know, modeling behaviors we know is key. And that modeling, of course, we make the presumption that has to come from parents, but siblings and friends and peers all play like a key role in that modeling and in that setting that examples. Role models don't just have to be parents. They can be a variety of different positive influences for the child in their environment.
And I think that is important. And I might bring Rebecca just on this point, because I get lots of parents that come in with bribes, you know, from a car to a train to a piece of chocolate to, you know. So Rebecca, what do you think about bribes for a picky eater? I'm sure you get that too.
So we try to avoid having a bribe for trying, a more of a reward system. You do want to encourage it, because there's not enough motivation right now in children at the age and the ability to grasp the subject of nutrition. So utilizing something that's tangible, that is going to be sustainable, such as sticker charts. We often use weekly rewards and then a monthly reward for finishing a food exposure. So you do want to give them some positive encouragement in addition to, you know, the parents and clinicians giving them praise. That way they feel like they're accomplishing something.
Yeah. And Chris, do you sometimes use some kind of system, reward system or anything like that?
I think, yeah, we definitely use rewards. I think the key is to try to find ones that focus on having positive benefit for the child. So there's no doubt that spending time with the parent, dedicated time, is a really powerful reward for the that age group, that toddler kind of age group. You know, what they want more than anything is quality time with their parents. So this can be actually really powerful. It's free, it doesn't take a lot of effort, and actually it's really very useful. So certainly we definitely suggest to families that they reward children for good behavior with dedicated time with them as the parent. Yeah. Working on a puzzle or reading together.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I do what I call emotional rewards, you know, a little bit longer to the park, a story at night when, you know, on one evening, not during school week, where they can stay up 10 minutes longer and cuddle with the parent. So I totally agree. Yeah. So the next question really is, you know, Chris, you gave these very handy kind of tips. And we had a lot of discussion or a lot of questions around limited time within a consultation. So one of the questions that asked was, if you have limited time in a consultation with a new case of a picky eater, what are your, they ask you, 2 to 3 goals that you'd in a limited time scale would like to achieve?
Okay, well, I think the key goals are, as I mentioned before, is ensuring the adequacy of the diet. Now, that is a key goal. That's a key responsibility of us as health professionals. That's a key responsibility for the parents to be on board with. I think the other clear goal is, you know, modeling mealtimes in a positive environment. That should be held up as the number one goal for families to strive towards in outcomes for picky eating children.
I think that's an amazing answer. The last question around this specific topic of practical advice for picky eaters, when we'll come to Arvid, but I think it's important for both of you. There's, of course, a lot of parental behavior and anxiety involved when it comes to picky eating. I'm going to start with Rebecca. Are there any specific tips that you have in regards to, you know, how do you change the parents' behavior and how do you reduce that immense anxiety that they have?
So that is a huge aspect of treating ARFID and with any child that comes to see me in my practice, is first working with the parent and empowering the parent that they know their child best. And when they exhibit anxiety and panic, these things can overflow into the child's behavior. So really educating the patient and educating the parent as well. So letting the parent know, there is going to be struggles. There is going to be times where it's frustrating and you feel helpless, but you need to kind of take a step back and look at the big picture that this is a process. It's going to take some time. There's going to be some behavior aspect to it. So if you give the child's parents empowerment and you give them part of your time in order to really feel that they are equipped with what they need to navigate this exposure, I think that that helps immensely with a child going through these types of initial exposures and trending with food.
And Chris, I mean, Rebecca now answered the question around ARFID. What is your experience in terms of picky eating?
I think very much the same kind of principles that Rebecca's discussed there. But I would say ultimately, how we should approach it is definitely carefully. You know, we are there to help the family, and to do this, we need to build a relationship. And this is key to changing behaviors. So starting that relationship off really well is really important. And I think for me, picky eaters, the most important thing is to take the time to listen to the family and understand that individual situation. You know, you may have heard 100 stories of picky eating before, but each one does have something individual about it. And it's really important, I think, we give the families that opportunity to tell that story and that we take the time to listen to them.
I think that's an important message, because often you're the first one that has listened to them for ages. They might have just been, labeled as, you know, a child that just does not want to eat. And I think from my side also, I always say it's about what are the expectations the parents have, because often the anxiety and the way you change their behavior is they often want you to just fix it overnight. And that's, of course, not going to happen. Mm-hmm. We're now moving to the next section of the questions, which is really around oral nutritional supplements and its role plays both for picky eating and ARFID. And I think I'm going to start with you, Rebecca, because of course you deal with a more severe spectrum around ARFID. How would you combine oral nutritional supplements with the nutritional advice, or would you use oral nutritional supplements?
So oral nutrition supplements are most definitely warranted when we're seeing a child with ARFID. Depending on the severity is how much and how often we would be implementing that. A lot of times they are coming to us with nutritional deficiencies, they are undernourished. So getting them back on their growth curve, getting enough nutrition is imperative. And we do oftentimes utilize that oral nutrition supplement between meals to focus on getting more volume at mealtime so we can work with increasing the variety.
And Chris, for you, is that a similar experience in regards to oral nutritional supplements for picky eaters?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's some key principles to use an ONS in picky eaters. I think firstly, they definitely shouldn't replace meals. That's not the aim of them at all. If they do this, they're unlikely to be helpful in making progress. I think the key is in their name, that they're there to supplement the diet, not replace it. Second, I think it's really important to agree a time frame for their use at the start, and you want to make sure that you've definitely got some planned reviews. You don't want them to be being used indefinitely, and you don't want them to be being used without supervision. I think thirdly, we need to think that don't underestimate the importance of that first time they try the supplement, particularly in the group of picky eaters. You know, they're not necessarily good with new food, so you've got to take the time to make the conditions right. You know, pick your moment. And I think you can think of this as the how, when, and where. How, they've definitely got to be, for example, the right temperature. You might want to deliver them using a familiar cup or using a special straw or novelty straw. The when, you want to do it when the child's in a good mood and when they're calm. And the where definitely is important. You know, trying oral supplements in a strange clinic room in a hospital is a very different social and emotional backdrop to them trying them at home. So I think it's always best to use familiar environments where they feel comfortable. I think we definitely need to sell it to them. I think we need to remember that when we use oral supplements, it's different motivations for the parent and the child. So for the parent, you know, we explain the benefit might be to help balance the macronutrients or to give more calories or to provide multiple micronutrients that they don't have in their diet. But these reasons are not motivational for the child. For them, the explanation has to be a little bit different. So you want to sell them to the child and tell them, explain that this drink's going to give them more calories. You know, it won't mean anything you've got to say these will help them make them stronger, or these will help them run faster, or they'll give them more energy to play. You've got to make it specific to the child. And lastly, I think, as Rebecca mentioned, you know, the timing of when they happen in the day is really important. Certainly, I tend to use them more near the end of the day, where they won't necessarily downregulate calorie intake throughout the day when you're trying to increase that variety and intake during the day.
Thank you for both of you for that answer. So the next one, actually, I think all of us have gone through that before, so not everybody likes the oral nutritional supplements. So what do you do then? So Rebecca, again, you deal with a kind of more severe spectrum. So what if you've used your whole repertoire of oral nutritional supplements? So what do you do then?
So the first thing that we would do is see if we can adjust the oral nutrition supplement. So that means adding to it. Do they like chocolate? Can we order chocolate syrup and add that in? Do they like strawberries? Is there sprinkles that they're fond of? Can we put the sprinkles in the supplement? So trying to make the supplement itself a little bit more exciting, more pleasurable, well accepted, making it fun, just as Chris said, adding in some fun aspects of it. Is it a different cup, straw, etc.? If that does not work and we can't get that to work, the next step would be modifying their favorite or safe foods. So it might mean taking some of their safe foods and modifying that to make it more calorically dense, such as adding MCT oil, adding a dry milk powder, whatever we can get in there, even if it means that we're adding, you know, extra butter to mashed potatoes, or we're adding Carnation instant breakfast or some type of powder into their solid food. If that doesn't, the last resort would be going to enteral nutrition. But modifying and making the oral nutrition supplement a little bit more fun and exciting to the child usually makes it a little bit easier to transition to get them to take the entire amount.
And Chris, what do you do if they refuse it at all? You've tried all your little tricks, temperature, timing, everything.
Well, I think Rebecca's given you some fantastic suggestions there too. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes we have to think more broadly about why a child isn't taking them. You know, what are other factors playing a role? So I think we have to consider compliance sometimes. And this may be based, for example, on the child's perception of the importance of what they're being offered. You know, so sometimes describing the supplements as a medicine rather than as a nutritional supplement may help some children to understand it slightly better, or maybe more be more compliant with it. And I would also consider, if they're not taking it, just be clear that the parents are actually on board and that their perception is correct too. Because definitely in pediatrics, you know, we have a communication triangle. We have the parent, we have the child, and we have the dietitian. It's not one-to-one. So the parent might want the child to take the supplement, for example, and you might want the child to take the supplement. But if the child doesn't want to, it's not going to happen. You need all three sides to be in agreement. Likewise, there can be some situations where we have to consider that maybe the parent's not on board. So maybe the child is happy to take them, and you, the dietitian, you want them to take it, but maybe the parent, you know, might forget, or maybe doesn't agree with this approach, but didn't feel comfortable to tell you. So again, if all the three sides aren't in alignment, it won't work. So I would definitely do all the things that Rebecca has mentioned. It's a great list there, but I also think broadly as well, think about the compliance and try and see whether there's another aspect there that we're missing.
And, you know, for both of you, there's this kind of question always around, do you go for the oral nutritional supplements, or do you go for vitamin and mineral supplements and then look at the diet and say, what can you add naturally in regards to foods? I'm going to start with you, Chris. I mean, I feel you've answered a lot of it, but, you know, is there an or situation where you're saying I'm going oral nutritional supplement, or I'm going vitamin and mineral, or do you kind of see it as a kind of fluid situation where you kind of pick what is suitable for the child at that specific moment?
Yeah, definitely. I think both ONS and vitamin mineral supplements, they have different characteristics that make them more or less applicable in certain situations. So vitamin and mineral supplements, they're often small tablets, low volume, they might have no taste or very little taste. And this may all be a big advantage, but of course they're limited to just being vitamins and minerals. But the ONS, of course, they're larger volumes and we're much more reliant on their taste, but they provide not just vitamins and minerals, but the extra calories and fiber that you wouldn't get in a vitamin and mineral supplement. I think regardless you need them to be taken. So compliance is key for whichever one you use. And definitely if you've got a child who refuses the oral supplements but requires additional calories as well as nutrients, then of course you can fortify the diet where you can. But definitely my preference would be to always try to balance the diet using real foods. But in reality, the nature of this situation, realistically introducing certain foods, particularly new ones, and establishing them consistently in the diet to fill a nutrient hole is unlikely to be successful overnight. This is our goal, but it's going to take time and we need something to support it in the meantime. And I don't want parents to feel rushed to widen the diet, as this will immediately make mealtimes more pressured and therefore much less likely to succeed. If we're trying to reduce the mealtime stress as a key principle to improve eating behaviors, then really telling families they must get this amount of food in to address that nutrient may well not be helpful. So definitely my preference would be to try and balance the diet with real foods. But in the short term, this may be where there's a real role for the vitamin supplement or the ONS.
And Rebecca, anything to add to that?
So Chris did a really good job of kind of covering it. I have to agree with that. It's highly individualized whether we're implementing a multivitamin, if we're implementing oral nutrition supplements, or using both. I would say the goal sometimes is to get two in one. Oftentimes, those with RFID also have a hard time tolerating the chewable vitamins and also swallowing. So using that oral nutrition supplement as to get two birds with one stone, you're getting the caloric density and you're getting the multivitamins, is a good way. If that is not working and we can't get both of those issues addressed in the same time, then we may need to identify what nutrient is at risk for deficiency or is deficient already, and then try to take it from there. But certainly if we're going to be doing an oral nutrition supplement already, because that child is having struggles getting enough caloric density in with just solid foods, then we're going to definitely try to max out that multivitamin that's coming from both the oral nutrition supplement and then anything that needs to be replaced, we're adding in addition with a multivitamin.
So finally, we're going into specific questions around ARFID, because we had quite a lot of those questions and there seems to be quite a lot of confusion. So one of the questions we had was, what's the difference between severe ARFID and failure to thrive, which I think is most probably an easy question to answer for you, Rebecca.
Correct. So failure to thrive can be the cause of ARFID, meaning they have ARFID, they're getting to the point where they're dropping percentiles, they're dropping weight, they are now at the failure to thrive. The ARFID ultimately is some of the symptoms and the cause, and then failure to thrive is just the drop in weight and the drop in actually being able to have those normal daily functions. So it's used separately. It's not one or the other. Usually, yeah, ARFID, they would come to see me, and if they are at failure to thrive, we'd be a lot more aggressive.
Yeah, and it is a possibility that it may be part of the diagnostic criteria, but it's not an essential part of the diagnostic
Correct.
Criteria. So again, going down the route of confusion, and this is a common, well, I wouldn't call it confusion, but it is a tricky one. The question is about the ARFID diagnosis and how many of those also have autism.
That's correct. So when we're looking at autism and when we're looking at ARFID, the pathway in one that has kind of those behaviors of autism or is on the spectrum, they may have ARFID because of the diagnosis of autism. There is a high correlation with those with cognitive development or learning deficits to have ARFID. So those with autism, ADHD, they may have ARFID. This might be part of what they're dealing with this diagnosis.
Exactly, because of course they've got sensory integration disorder, and that is a factor that limits the variety of foods that they have. But just to clarify, it's not that you can have only one or the other.
Correct.
You can have both.
Correct.
And I think the next question is really challenging you, because it talks about the difference between autism, picky eaters, and ARFID, because I know it kind of flows a little bit together.
It does. So we're looking at two different aspects. One is their nutrition. We're talking about picky eating. We're talking about ARFID. The other aspect is a totally different diagnosis. It's a totally more broad spectrum. This doesn't only affect their nutrition. This affects all aspects of their life. So really, when we're looking at it, this is a broad diagnosis, a large diagnosis compared to something that's one aspect of the child's life. So, you know, when we're looking at depression or anxiety, these are causes or possible correlations for somebody to have picky eating or ultimately to have ARFID.
And of course, for ARFID, there's a very specific criteria set. Whereas Chris had previously highlighted, when it comes to picky eating, it becomes a little bit complicated to get a specific definition. And autism, you have a criteria for a diagnosis, but the diagnosis does not talk about the feeding. So I can see it becomes complicated. Now, Rebecca, I'm going to repeat those questions that I've asked Chris for picky eating. Is there a simple step-by-step plan to help parents and children with ARFID increase their repertoire?
Yes. So it's all about presence and not pressure. Consistency is the key here. So whether it means exposing the food on the plate at the dinner table or having separate food exposures, consistency and expecting the child to take a while to be comfortable around the food. Oftentimes I'll hear parents saying, well, we tried it two or three times. She clearly doesn't like it or he's not accepting it. That's okay. We want to really pay attention to the 10th, 15th time. We know the 0 to 3 talks about how many times it takes a toddler to have a food exposure before they learn to accept it. And that's about 10 to 15 times. And as you move up the ranks with age, 5+, it's going to be more and more exposures. So if we take a child that's 8, 9, 10, 11, the progress is in their comfortability with being with the food. If it means they touched the food, if it means they allowed it to be on their plate, if it means that they took a sniff of it or they put it to their lips, that counts as progress. We are not getting the child to like the food. They don't have to like the food. The goal is ultimately for them to feel comfortable enough to accept the food at any volume at this point. So really giving them a long process, a long-term process, and saying, hey, this is going to take 20, 30 tries. And we're not going to the point where we think they're going to accept a full amount or a full portion within that time frame. We want to get them to the point where they're just comfortable around the food. And then that progress of having regular portions will come naturally.
I think this is a great time to end this podcast. And I think everybody that has listened to the podcast would have had lots of nuggets of practical information, both to you, and hope you have a good rest of the day.
Thanks, Roseanne.
Thank you.
Date with future episodes of Danone Nutrition Campus, the Feed podcast. Make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, or for more educational content from Danone Nutrition Campus, visit www.danonenutritioncampus.org.